could handle over a period of 3 to 4 months. And it's assumed that the BIA is acting on behalf of the tribe with its expertise, but in fact it often does not, because of its role in relation to white society.
See, I think one of the things is that this kind of leads, this situation sort of perpetuates itself, in that it perpetuates outside control, because you're all of these problems, and practically to be an Indian you have to be a lawyer, and find out what your status is and what the status of your rights are and your land and so forth. So this kind of highly complex legal incrustation of reservations in Indian people just really perpetuates the outside interest and outside control of it, and leads to intends to keep Indians incompetent to do certain kinds of things. In other words, it doesn't encourage development of leadership that knows how to deal effectively with this structure around the reservation. So it's kind of a self-perpetuating situation, and this is what I think most groups are really tending to break out of. That's what we mean by self-determination.
So there's a kind of paternalism that's established almost accidentally to the whole way that the BIA relates to Indians.
It relates absolutely. I mean, you get this is given to the kid when he's taken away from the parents and sent to a boarding school. He gets it when he goes back, and it's just the whole history of this, several generations of it, you know. And it's kind of one of the things that outside control does. It saps you of, first of all, any ability you have to run your own affairs, you know. And second of all, I think it decreases an individual's worth in his community, you know, because he has no power in it at all, you know. Mm-hmm. And maybe his neighbor over there doesn't have any power, and so in a certain sense in which his neighbor isn't worth anything to him, you know. See, we're just all laying out there. And so consequently, you often have people at each other's throats because of the situation, you know, because there's nothing there, there's no power there, there's hopelessness. You're relying completely on the outside for their generosity, and yet you hate taking it.
So it has the effect of also breaking down the internal organization of tribes.
Yes, I think often, of course, tribal councils and so forth vary all over the country, but I think often that when you have an Indian community and you have white folks moving in on it, you know, and taking over all the functions of the community. So in order to deal with that, you set up a tribal council. And these are people that often are not necessarily the most representative of the people, but people who can best deal with that outside situation, you know. So you got to have some kind of structure to deal with all this stuff out there. So usually you get those kind of guys, and you get those kind of guys who are most in tune with the outside, you know, not those that are most in tune with what's going on the inside. And you tend to put those kind of guys in those positions, you know.
What's being done to alleviate this kind of situation? Because I know it's getting extremely bad in some areas. I'm thinking specifically of, say, the Hopi Reservation. I know there's quite a bit of conflict there. I was wondering if anything specifically is being done to change it. What can be done?
I wouldn't know about the Hopi so much as perhaps some other areas, but I think that when an organization is only as good as the people within it. And once I think that the tribes begin to have a voice in the selection of key people, not only in the Bureau, but in any other organization that deals in Indian affairs, once they have the opportunity to make decisions as to who has the key positions, and I'm talking about the people who make policies within any organization, then I think, you know, things will change. But until that such time as that happens, I don't think, you know, there isn't going to be much change. This is what I personally think.
From reading in the newspapers, it seems like there's very little love lost between Indians and Mr. Hickel, and I was wondering what the bone of contention is between Hickel and Indian groups throughout the country.
I mean, it's so it's so deep. All of his speeches are so paternalistic that it's difficult to believe that he doesn't know it, but apparently he doesn't. And the speech he gave at the National Congress of American Indians Convention, the speech he handed out, said, for example, he had seen a cartoon saying, if you like Custer, you'll love Hickel. He said, I think you're going to change your mind about that, and you're going to be saying, if you like Indians, you'll love Hickel. That's clearly just something about the man's style, except that style is a symptom of things he acted on in Alaska, things he's acted on. So he made a speech about it's time Indians cut the cord and stood up on their own 2 feet and so forth.
It's difficult to do when you're not given the power to be able to do that.
Well, I don't think there's any problem about Indians standing up on their own 2 feet. I think he means something else by that. He does that little twist of saying that as if reservations were given by the good graces of the American government and somehow stand as an eternal favor to Indian people. And that's a very peculiar way to read reservations. Hitler would say he did the Jews a favor by putting them in concentration camp to save them from the hostilities of their neighbors. And yet Hickel has talked about reservations as if they represent some sort of generosity.
How do Indians, on a sort of personal level, manage to keep their inward hostility? Or there must be some great hostility on the part of Indians toward the government and toward white culture in general for the kinds of mishandlings and deliberate actions that were taken against Indians, say, in the last century and the beginnings of this one, and in terms of breaking of treaties and so on and so forth. How do Indians deal with this? Because I think the classical picture that we have of Indians is sort of quaint people that you come to visit on the reservation, who really, really don't ever stand up and speak out against the kind of situation that they're living in, as if they actually preferred to live that way. Go ahead.
I don't know. But one thing that, I think we have to do at the moment is accept for whatever's happened in the past as a matter of fact, but at the same time, to the various dealings that the tribes have with the federal government, that they pursue the, or at least have the objective of perhaps regaining or gaining back some of that which they might have lost, regardless of what it might be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any other approach that we can use.
And another thing, the relationship, the closeness of Indian families and the way Indians think of each other and the way Indians cooperate with each other, that kind of existence is a very real, and can be a very satisfying kind of life. This is what can hold people together through all kinds of adversity. The Indian culture is strong, and when where it is strong, people see these bad things going on, but their lifestyle, their life, and the way they look at themselves are not, critically threatened. Some kind of immediate attack on them. It's a very Indian life is a very satisfying way to live. It's a very strong way.
What? Recently, of course, in San Francisco, there's been some kind of action taken regarding Alcatraz. What are the basic issues behind the actions that have been taken in maintaining Alcatraz as a kind of place where Indians are free to come and so on and so forth? What is the basic issue involved?
Well,
Well, I think it's a symbolic act. I think the symbolism of the island is probably the most important thing, though I don't think any of us are involved in that particular project, and I think people involved in it, I suppose, could speak better for themselves. But I think, to me, it's a symbolic sort of thing. The physical land there, it really doesn't excite me too much. I mean, back home we have 150 square miles of trees and mountains and so forth, and it's pretty hard for me to get excited over 12 acres of rock out in the middle of the ocean, you know, unless it has some kind of symbolic value.
I'm fishing for questions here again. It's because of my lack of knowledge of what's going on. Is there anything that I should specifically bring up that we could talk about?
Go ahead. I want to say something about the earlier question and as it relates to Alcatraz. There's a very strong Indian stereotype is that of all accepting during the fall. One of the images you hear at Indian industrial conferences, it's said in a very different way. What it amounts to is Indians are cheap, docile labor, fiercely loyal, manually dexterous, that sort of thing. But on the one of accepting, I think there is a kind of Indian leader who believes strongly that that no action should be taken that would be offensive to anyone because it's necessary, because of this relatively small size of the Indian community. It's necessary to rely always on power, friends, and these people would look down on any action that would seem to be abrasive. I know of two different meetings of affiliated tribes where the question of Alcatraz was brought up to a vote for regional support, and in both cases, they did not vote on it. They tabled it as a question, and they wanted to know more about it. And I think the reason for this conservatism has to do with a history that certainly whites have gone out of their way to push. Now look, there you are, and we can help you or not help you. And if you're very good, we'll help you. And if you're not very good, maybe we won't help you.
So people are afraid to like muddy the waters or make them more turbulent than they maybe already are.
Yeah, I think at a meeting at which no vote was taken on Alcatraz, Commissioner Bruce asked the group what he should do. There's a group that seized his offices in Chicago and had made a series of demands. Should he give in to their demands? And that they did vote on. No, he absolutely should not. And no one should give in to demands that are made through coercion. And I think it's an approach that that don't offend anyone approach is one that I think will clearly not work, has not worked, shows no sign of working. But I certainly understand why people continue to practice that approach.
In social movements within white culture, there have been various different sort of attitudes taken, and one of those would be more or less a radical sort of position where people have finally gotten tired of going through channels and not getting things done. It doesn't seem to me that there is any corresponding sort of movement within the Indian community. Is this partly responsible for it, this attitude of conservatism because of not wanting to offend people?
Well, I think one of the things is that most people, Indians involved in Indian affairs, always act within the context of their own community. You know, whereas perhaps a SDS radical, he completely cut himself off from his parents, his community, and everything. And I think especially Indian young people who are asking for change are very conscious of the fact that they're of their mother and their father and their parents and their community, where they come from. even though they may be just as hot under the collar about different sort of things, that influences the style that he might go about trying to improve his people and the way he